Afternoon, David. Nabil, how are y'all? Hey Joy, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing all right. And we're winding down. We're almost finished. Here, I'll go ahead and share the doc with you guys. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do this a little different. First of all, I think our time's going to be limited to like 40 minutes on here. So I'm just going to quickly go through. All I'm going to do today is talk about the Progressive Era and U.S. imperialism. So we'll go fairly quickly. What I'll probably do is tomorrow and Thursday, I'll kind of finish up. I'll have two other little shorter sessions where I'll finish up talking about period seven. So we'll do, like I said, the Progressive Era imperialism. Tomorrow I'll probably do World War One up through like the 20s with the Great Depression. And then we'll do on Thursday, I'll focus on the New Deal and World War Two. Remember this, period seven is the last bit of content that will be whatever the DBQ topic is, it'll be from that. Okay. I'm going to go and get started just because like I said, I think my free trial is up on Zoom. If we get kicked out, I'll message off. We get cut short. But like I said, I don't think this will take too long. And I did, before we leave, I did want to talk real quick about just the day of stuff. If you guys have not, make sure you go onto the blog and read that AP like exam guide. You need to go to that little slide, that PDF thing that College Board made. Because, you know, if you remember, Wednesday, you're going to get your ticket. Make sure on AP's website that your email is updated correctly. So Wednesday, you will get that email. Because if you don't get the email, you're going to have to log into College Board and, like, find your AP ID. You'd rather not have to worry. You want to get all that handled before test day. I think most of y'all said, do any of y'all have the English exam? Someone said they had the English exam. I think most of y'all were only taking the U.S. exam. So anyway, are any of y'all taking the English, any other exams, AP exams? If not, then, I mean, that's good. Cause you can kind of just focus on, obviously what's this exam and, you know, Friday is all you got to worry about. All right. I'm going to go ahead, like I said, jump in. Again, I'll upload this. This is only part one. Again, I'm not going to try to kill you today, a little bit shorter. If you're not going to be able to make the last couple of reviews on like tomorrow and Thursday, definitely go review period seven on your own. I think most of you guys have been in all the review sessions, so I'm not worried about y'all in particular. Make sure you got everything prepared before test day so you're ready to go. Make sure you know what device you're using. Make sure you have done the demo that I sent out so you can make sure everything's working. You'll know how it looks. Make sure you've decided if you're going to write your DBQ on your computer, your tablet, your phone, or if you're going to do it on paper and then upload it. I'll talk about some of that other stuff the next couple of days. And at the end of this, we have time. But anybody have questions before I jump into this about the test itself or test day or content or anything? All right, I'm going to go ahead and hop in. So we left off period six. We were talking about the Gilded Age. Remember, the Gilded Age is roughly like 1865 to I'd say about 1900-ish, that post-Civil War period when the U.S. economy really starts to industrialize. We talked about how the U.S. economy booms. You know, really the foundation of this economic boom after the Civil War is the railroads. We talked about how the steel, oil, coal industry, all these, the U.S., kind of the modern U.S. economy develops. We talked about some of the major innovators, you know, kind of entrepreneurs like Carnegie and Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan. We talked about what life is like for immigrants in this time period. Remember, a lot of immigrants coming from Eastern Southern Europe after the Civil War, working in these urban factories, and their living and working conditions are often terrible. We talked about labor unions. Make sure you kind of know some of those major strikes and some of the big unions. We talked about westward expansion during this period, about how the U.S. population really starts to fill in all that Western territory after the Civil War. And of course, we talked about how the conflict between the Great Plains Indians and the U.S. Army really kind of hits a high point by the 1890s with the Wounded Knee Massacre, and then all the Native American tribes are put on the reservations. Today, we're going to talk about the Progressive Era. If you remember, the Progressive Era, again, is some of these, I know, eras kind of overlap, and that's just kind of the way it is. The Progressive Era there is roughly 1890 to about 1920, so it's like the very beginning of the 1900s. And if you remember, basically what the Progressive Era is a direct response to the problems that were kind of created during the Gilded Age. Remember, the Gilded Age is a time of like rapid change. You know, after the Civil War, we're going through this rapid industrialization, we're going through urbanization, and we saw there's always a lot of problems because of this. Especially, you know, for working class people who are living in these like increasingly crowded cities. So you do want to know the Progressive Era is named after this group called the Progressives, who are reformers who kind of come to prominence and really kind of start speaking out in the early 1900s. And their goal is essentially to fix some of these social, political, economic issues that we saw that were created during this industrial boom after the Civil War. I would definitely know this, the Progressives' goal is basically to get the federal government more involved, and they want the federal government to essentially try to fix these problems that they have kind of singled out. Some examples would be they want the government to get rid of political corruption, they want the government to intervene in the economy more, to prevent like unethical business practices like monopolies and things like that. They want the government to step in to protect consumers and workers who a lot of times are being kind of exploited and taken advantage of by these big corporations. And then, you know, just in general, they want the government to step in and try to alleviate some of these social problems that have developed during this kind of industrialization phase, things like poverty, child labor. So key stuff, and I've tried to like this stuff that I've put in bold and I've kind of italicized. This is important. Progressives want the federal government to take a larger role in trying to guarantee the welfare of the public. And that's important because really up to this point, really throughout the 1700s, 1800s, most Americans have felt the federal government needs to play a pretty limited role, you know, as much as possible. I mean, obviously we talked about how, you know, when the Constitution is being written, they want, you know, people like Hamilton and Madison wanted a stronger central government, but still, even, you know, by today's standards, those guys, those founding fathers, still wanted the government to be fairly limited in how much it was involved in kind of, a lot of aspects of American life. So in a lot of ways, this is kind of big picture stuff that would be important if you have to write about the Progressive Era, is we really see kind of a shift in the way Americans think about the federal government, the central government during this period. And this is really caused by these progressives. And the big shift is, people start to see the government as not so much of a threat to kind of their welfare or liberty, but more as like an entity that's supposed to protect them, like, and make sure they have the things they need. So this is kind of a changing conception of the government that's happening here. And the progressives, these reformers in the early 1900s, are really kind of pushing this idea. Again, that's in bold there, the idea that one of the federal government's roles should be to improve American society. And this is kind of a new idea at this time that, you know, this is one of the responsibilities of the federal government is to make sure that, you know, the public is, you know, basically look after the welfare. Okay. All right. You do want to know about the muckrakers. These people play a major role during like trying to bring about reform during the Progressive Era. Remember, muckraker is just a term for these investigative journalists during this period, during the late 1800s, early 1900s. And these, basically what these journalists are doing is they are trying to expose kind of the social, political, economic problems, you know, of this time period. And the idea is, you know, by writing about this stuff, photographing it, whatever the case may be, they are kind of exposing these problems to the public, you know, generating kind of a support to, you know, for the government to step in and make a change. So again, the idea is if you don't have the problems there, then nothing's probably going to happen. So the kind of the mission of muckrakers, these investigative journalists, is to, again, rake up the muck, the dirty stuff, and kind of expose it to the public. And, you know, hopefully the idea is the government will step in and try to alleviate some of these problems, okay? Some famous muckrakers you want to know from the Progressive Era are Upton Sinclair, probably the most famous. He writes a book called The Jungle in 1906. This book is all about the meatpacking industry in Chicago and about essentially about how just unsanitary these places were. There were no kind of, remember, there's no government regulation really at this point. You know, it's kind of the Wild Wild West in terms of, you know, corporations, factories. The government is not like kind of intervening into this yet. And basically this book exposed to a lot of people this kind of disgusting, unsanitary things that were going on inside of these meat packing plants, kind of, you know, the potentially harmful things that were going into people's food. And ultimately, you want to know, this book's very influential. It leads to the passage of two laws. One's called the Pure Food and Drug Act, which basically makes sure that companies have to like accurately label food and pharmaceuticals. They can't like, you know, make false claims about what's in their product. They have to be clear about the ingredients. They have to meet obviously certain like safety factor, like, you know, regulations in terms of what's going into their product. And the other one is the Meat Inspection Act, which again is just where the governments go in and basically think about kind of like a food inspector going in and making sure that these meat processing plants are following certain guidelines, you know, there are certain safety sanitation regulations, right? So again, this is the beginning of, you can see with something like this, you know, in this case, Upton Sinclair is successful. This book really changes American society because it causes the government to start taking a much more active kind of oversight role in the food and the pharmaceutical industries, where the government is actively kind of making sure these businesses are doing, you know, right by their customers or employees, okay? Another important muckraker is Ida Tarbell. If you remember Ida Tarbell, female journalist, her father had been like bought out, he owned an oil company, which had been essentially bought up by Standard Oil. So she writes this expose piece called The History of Standard Oil, where basically she investigated kind of the business doings of Rockefeller's company, Standard Oil, and basically uncovered that Standard Oil had been engaged in a lot of illegal practices, in particular things like creating kind of business cartels, making these secret kind of deals with railroad companies where they would give him like a price cut, and that way he could run his competitors out of business. Ultimately, this book's also very important because it leads to the central government stepping in and ultimately breaking up this monopoly, the Standard Oil Company, into like multiple smaller oil companies. And the law that helps that happen is a law called the Sherman Antitrust Act. If you see any kind of thing about an antitrust act, remember, a trust is just a name for one of these like powerful monopolies, corporations that's bought up all these other businesses. So antitrust laws are laws that are basically designed to break up monopolies, right? And this is one of the first times that this law is actually used the way it's supposed to be used. If you remember, a lot of times during the Gilded Age in the late 1800s, the Sherman Antitrust Act was actually used more to go after labor unions. But we'll see during the Progressive Era, the government will start to actually use these laws as they're meant to be used to actually go after monopolies. Another muckraker I would know is Jacob Riis, who was actually a Danish immigrant who was a photographer. He publishes a famous book called How the Other Half Lives, which is like an early book in photojournalism, where essentially he's going into tenements, these slums in the cities where, you know, these urban poor live, and basically taking photographs of these terrible living conditions and basically exposing them to the public. This will also lead to like tenement laws, which, you know, set certain regulations for these tenements where they have to have a certain amount of ventilation, lighting, certain, you know, like building regulations for safer tenements, things like that. Okay. Any questions about muckrakers? And then we'll look at some of these, the problems of the Gilded Age, and then kind of like the, how these reformers step in and fix them. All right. All right, so we'll take this one at a time. What I'll do is I'll talk about the problem, the Gilded Age problem, and then we'll talk about the progressive reform. So one you want to know definitely is political corruption. If you remember, these monopolies have a lot of influence in the national government during this time. Also at the local and like state level, there are these organizations called political machines, which really dominate politics. They essentially, where they give immigrants like services in exchange for votes, but a lot of times these machines are taking taxpayers' money to, for their own benefit. We talked about, you know, Tammany Hall, that famous political machine that ran New York City in the late 1800s. Some reforms you want to know that are passed in the Progressive Era to try to end some of this political corruption, in particular to give people kind of back more control over the government, are these. I didn't take the time to define these. You might, if you don't know these, you might want to go look these up. An initiative essentially allows citizens to propose new laws. They don't have to wait for the state legislator to propose laws. Referendum is basically where if an initiative is successful, if a citizen proposes a law, gets enough support, then states have to allow the people to vote on that proposed law. That's the vote itself is called a referendum. Recall, remember, is where essentially people can force another election and remove an elected official from office. This is at the state and local level. And then the 17th Amendment, remember, is the amendment that basically says the citizens of a state get to elect their senators. Before this amendment, the state governments chose the two senators for the state, but this allowed the people to directly vote for the senators. So all these things allow people to have more control over kind of the political process. So these are some of the political reforms you want to have from the Progressive Era. Another problem from the Gilded Age we already know is monopolies. You know, we have this corporate consolidation, you know, through things like vertical and horizontal integration. And essentially, these monopolies have eliminated competition. You know, they take advantage of consumers. You want to know that Ida Tarbell's book, History of Standard Oil, is a big kind of step toward the government stepping in and getting rid of monopolies. Definitely know this. Some of these progressive presidents like Theodore Roosevelt, Taft, Wilson, they will start using these laws like the Sherman Antitrust Act and the Clayton Antitrust Act, which actually kind of like clarifies some of the stuff in the Sherman Antitrust Act. And they will use these laws to break up these harmful monopolies. So during the Progressive Era, you start to see that, you know, the government, if you remember in the period before this, during the Gilded Age, had a kind of a laissez-faire policy where they kind of stayed out of the economy. That will start to change when the Progressive Era, the government's going to start stepping in and like trying to, you know, regulate the economy more thoroughly, break up these harmful monopolies using these antitrust laws, right? You want to know, health of the American consumer was a problem. We already talked about this. The meatpacking industry was a great example. They were, you know, all kinds of stuff was going into these canned meat products. There was no sanitation regulations. Pharmaceutical industries would mislabel their product, make false claims about their medicine. So you do want to know, we talked about laws like the Pure Food and Drug Act, the Meat Inspection Act that are passed in the wake of that book, The Jungle. Those will, another example of the government stepping in and trying to regulate business more to protect the American public, to make sure that, you know, what we're eating, what we're taking as far as medicine is safe, okay? Environmental waste is a big problem. Obviously, we know during the Gilded Age, corporations are, you know, booming. They need resources. They're trying to, they're really using up a lot of these, exhausting out of America's natural resources for profit. And remember, you definitely want to know the progressive president, Teddy Roosevelt, who's a big conservationist. He's influenced a lot by this naturalist named John Muir, who founded a group called the Sierra Club, who was, you know, big into protecting you know, the environment. You want to know that ultimately a big thing I would know is Teddy Roosevelt's a conservationist. As a progressive president, he will set aside millions of acres of the United States as national forests and parks, okay, to basically ensure that this land is kind of under the control of the federal government and is off limits to these corporations, all right? Tenements and poverty is a problem in cities. Remember, these immigrant laborers are living in these terrible apartment complexes. Poverty, child labor is common. So some of the reforms you want to know, definitely know this woman, Jane Addams, who is, her mission is kind of to help the urban poor. She will found this organization called the Whole House in Chicago, which is, the Whole House is the first famous example we call settlement homes. Settlement homes are essentially places that provide social services for immigrants. Poor immigrants could go here and they could get food, they get medical care, they could have a place to stay for a while if they need it. They could get English classes to help them, you know, learn the language, to get jobs. They had like daycare programs for these families. So the Whole House, definitely know, is an example of a settlement house, a place that provides these, like I said, kind of these social services to immigrants. And we'll see settlement houses will spring up in other big cities too, kind of modeling themselves after the Whole House. Also, I would know Jacob Riis, his book of How the Other Half Lives, will lead to like laws trying to improve tenements. Okay. Alcohol abuse was still, if you remember, this is not new. Back in the early 1800s, if you remember, back in the antebellum before the Civil War, we had a slew of reform notes back then too. And that's important to know, right? Because if you have like a DBQ essay on this, it's probably going to ask you to kind of like compare and contrast or kind of connect this to other time periods. Don't forget, there was a slew of reform movements in the early 1800s. You know, we had like abolitionism, temperance, the Seneca Falls Convention, education reform. And now about 100 years later, we have another group of reform movements called the Progressive Era. So alcohol abuse is still considered a problem in American society. They think a lot of times it's the root of these other problems. So you do want to know, there's an organization called the Women's Christian Temperance Union, where temperance just is advocating the reduction of the consumption of alcohol. And you want to know definitely, ultimately, that the prohibition movement is successful. In 1919, the 18th Amendment is ratified. And this will basically begin the period known as prohibition. Okay. Women's rights is an ongoing struggle. Again, this was another, remember, back in the early 1800s, the women's rights movement got started with the Seneca Falls Convention. So that has continued. This push for women's rights has continued up into the early 1900s. I would definitely know about the National American Women's Suffrage Association, NASA. That's a mouthful. That's led by Susan B. Anthony and Carrie Chapman Catt. And definitely, you would know they are ultimately successful. The 19th Amendment is ratified in 1920, which grants women suffrage. All right. Very important. So these are just some of the kind of problems of the Gilded Age society at that time, then kind of some of these progressive reform movements and kind of how what they came up with to try to fix them. Okay. I would definitely know this. Again, just I already mentioned most of these, but some important progressive era amendments that are passed during this time. The 16th Amendment creates an income tax to try to, you know, tax the wealthy more. 17th Amendment is the direct election of senators, allows the people in each state to elect their senators. 18th Amendment is prohibition, where that basically outlaws the production, the sale, and the transportation of alcohol. Remember, that doesn't last very long. It only lasts until like 1932. And the 19th Amendment gives women suffrage, right? Some of the progressive presidents you want to know, like the presidents during the Progressive Era who are really kind of promoting this idea of the government as kind of the protector of the American public, you know, promoting this idea of the government getting more involved in the economy and society to try to, you know, make sure the American public is safe and has what they need. You do want to know Teddy Roosevelt is considered kind of the first progressive president. He thought it was kind of the role of the president to, like I said, protect the American public. He was a big supporter of the Pure Food and Drug Act and the Meat Inspection Act. He read Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, and it had a profound influence on him. You do want to know, he got a reputation as a trust buster. He will use the Sherman Antitrust Act to go after harmful monopolies. He didn't go after all monopolies, but he did go after the ones he thought were kind of detrimental to society. He also successfully negotiated this strike that happened in 1902 called the Anthracite Coal Strike, where coal workers went on strike. They had a kind of a showdown with management. And really, this is a big deal because for the first time, the government will intervene as a neutral arbiter. Usually, if you remember, in the previous strikes we've seen, the government usually intervened on behalf of the business and usually would use the military or the National Guard to stop the strike. Teddy Roosevelt kind of changes this in his coal strike. He steps in and basically negotiates, basically kind of requires the coal company to give the workers better pay, better hours. So this is in some ways a kind of watershed moment because the government is now intervening kind of to help workers to an extent. He also promotes this idea called the square deal. And this is kind of, he basically says all people, you know, basically his goal is to help all the American public. I would note the parts of the square deal are conservation. He wants to conserve natural resources, control of corporations. He wants to break up harmful monopolies, and then consumer protection, you know, making sure that businesses are regulated. They have government oversight. So they're, you know, they're not selling harmful products to the public. Okay. After Roosevelt steps down, you want to know his successor is William H. Taft, who is his vice president. He actually breaks up twice as many trusts as Teddy Roosevelt. He'll establish the Department of Labor and pushes for child labor laws. If you remember, Taft and Roosevelt eventually have like a falling out because Taft actually allows some of the land that Roosevelt set aside as, you know, kind of protected land. He allows it to be sold to industrialists, which upsets Teddy. Woodrow Wilson, who's elected in 1912, he'll do want to know a little bit about the 1912 election. You know, Taft runs for re-election, but Teddy Roosevelt will kind of return to politics because he's upset with Taft, and he actually runs as a third party candidate for this new party he helped set up called the Progressive Party. A lot of times it's called the Bull Moose Party. Ultimately, Wilson, the Democrat, wins because Taft and Roosevelt kind of split the Republican vote. But I would know Wilson will use the Clayton Antitrust Act to go after monopolies, kind of like Taft and Roosevelt did. And then also he'll establish the Federal Reserve, which is kind of like a new central bank that really kind of regulates the U.S. monetary system. It helps prevent some of these like economic panics that we've had in the late 1800s. All right. Any questions about the progressive era before I jump into imperialism real quick? All right. No questions. So, by the way, this is all kind of happening at the same time, you know, the progressive era, the and this kind of change in U.S. foreign policy where the U.S. really starts to become an imperial power. Make sure you know what imperialism means. It's just this idea that a powerful country is essentially taking over, you know, new territory to establish an empire. That's where the empire is the root word for imperialism. So the U.S. will start to do this, will take a much more active kind of foreign policy role in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and will establish itself as an imperial power. And let's kind of talk briefly about why this happens. You need to know the motivations for imperialism. Like, why do we start to do this in the late 1800s? Why do we start looking beyond our own borders to take more territory? The first and most important reason is going to be our economy, right? Our economy is booming. After the Civil War, we go through this industrial explosion, and basically there's a high demand for new natural resources and new markets to sell these mass-produced goods to. And the idea is if we take more territory, you know, take control trade around the world, then we'll have access to more resources and new markets to sell stuff to. So that's one big motivation, probably the most important motivation for imperialism is economic reasons, all right? I would also know another reason is the frontier is basically closed by 1890. What I mean by that is basically the West has now been kind of civilized, or that's what Americans would say. It's basically become states by this point. There's no more like open frontier. And a lot of Americans feel like if the U.S. is going to continue to be a powerful country, it's going to need to look beyond its borders to keep expanding. So we've already taken everything from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Now we have to look outside of our borders to take more territory. And I would definitely know this idea, this theory called the frontier thesis, which I mentioned last time by this historian, Frederick Jackson Turner. This was basically the frontier thesis is this idea that America's success, its vitality as a country, kind of its democratic spirit is really the reason that it developed like that was because there was always a frontier. And that if we wanted to continue to be a strong nation, healthy nation, we had to look to new frontiers outside of the country. Okay. So it's kind of like the next step in Manifest Destiny, right? We've already taken everything in the continental U.S. Now we've got to look into foreign territory. I would also know another motivation for us becoming an imperial power is European powers are doing it. It's kind of like keeping up with the Joneses, like Britain, France, Germany, they're all colonizing Africa. Remember, there's the scramble for Africa during this period where these European powers partition Africa. They're also doing this in Asia and the Middle East as well. So America feels like if it wants to be a world power, it's got to do the same thing. Okay. Social Darwinism, another major thing you want to know, this idea that essentially certain cultures and races are superior. And this really is the idea that Anglo-Saxon, which is like white European English culture, is superior, and basically that it's kind of destined to expand around the world. There's this idea of the white man's burden. Make sure you know this. This, which comes from a poem or a Rudyard Kipling, this phrase, what it means is that it's kind of the duty of white Europeans to civilize the world, to spread democracy, spread Christianity, spread capitalism, spread technology, basically on these savage, kind of uncivilized people. Okay. This is just used as a justification for why the U.S. has the right to go in and take over these places. Basically, they're going to say, well, our culture, our society is superior, and basically you should want to be like us. Okay. Early examples of imperialism, I would know 1853, this is before the Civil War, the U.S. will send Commodore Matthew Perry to Japan with 4 battleships. Japan had basically gone inside this self-imposed isolation. They were not trading with anyone. And the U.S. basically goes in there with warships and tells Japan, you are going to trade with us, whether you like it or not. So again, this is kind of an idea of imperialism here. We want access to trade. So we basically forced Japan to open up a trade. In 1867, a couple of years after the Civil War, the U.S. will purchase Alaska from Russia. The man responsible for this is William Seward, who is Secretary of State. A lot of times, he got a lot of criticism for this when he did this. It was a lot of times called Seward's Folly, or Seward's Icebox, because they didn't know why do we buy this godforsaken icy region. Eventually, they discover gold there and oil later on, so it ends up, obviously, he'll have some validation later. But you also want to know in 1898, in the 1890s, remember, American businessmen in Hawaii will overthrow Queen Lily and will basically establish a new constitution. And eventually, the U.S. will annex Hawaii. Remember, the reason they do this is because these businessmen see, and the U.S. in general sees Hawaii as a kind of a valuable economic kind of resource for the country. Like I said, we'll annex Hawaii in 1898. It'll become a state later in the 1950s. In China, we promote this idea called the open door policy, where essentially the U.S. wants to trade with China. But the problem was European countries have basically monopolized trade. They essentially had taken control of certain areas of China and said, only we can trade there. And so the U.S. didn't think it was fair. So we will promote this policy called the open door policy. And eventually by 1901, these European powers will eventually allow us to do this, mainly because we helped put down the Boxer Rebellion in China. Remember, the Boxer Rebellion was one of these Chinese nationalists who were upset about kind of European control of China, revolted in Beijing. And ultimately the U.S. will, and a lot of other countries will help put this down. And after this, we really have access to trade in China. All right. The big war that's really going to establish us as a true imperial power, we already have Alaska, we'll get Hawaii around this time, but the big war that's going to really launch us as a true global power, an imperial power, is the Spanish-American War. This takes place in 1898. It's between Spain and the U.S., as the name implies. Let's talk about the causes real quick. If you remember, Cuba was a colony of Spain during this time. And in 1895, the Cuban people start rebelling. There's basically an independence movement. They want to be free from Spain. We get word that, Spain obviously doesn't want to lose Cuba, so they'll send their military down to stop this rebellion. And we get word that they are basically rounding up Cubans and putting them in internment camps. And basically, a lot of the Cuban people, the conditions of the camps are terrible. They're dying of starvation, disease. And you do want to know, American newspapers really latch onto this story, and they will publish, these exaggerated kind of sensationalized stories about what the Spanish are doing to the Cuban people. And the term for this kind of exaggeration is yellow journalism. You want to make sure you know that. You definitely want to know about really what sparks the war is in 1898, we send a ship down to Cuba to kind of check things out called the USS Maine, and mysteriously it explodes in the harbor of Havana. And, you know, newspapers, of course, this yellow journalism jumps on this, says this is the work of Spain. The Spanish torpedoed this ship. In reality, there was no proof for that. They were just kind of, this was a perfect example of yellow journalism. They were just kind of making this up to sell papers. But this will drum up support for the war. And eventually the U.S. will declare war on Spain in early 1898. And of course, the U.S., you know, we're not really doing this to protect Cuba as much as Americans might have tried to say that during this time. Really what the U.S. sees this as is as an opportunity to take territory from Spain. You know, if we defeat Spain, there's a power vacuum in Cuba and the Philippines and Guam, Puerto Rico, and maybe we can kind of slide in there and take control of those places, all right? So the war ends quickly. It's over like within 3 months. And the U.S. obviously defeats Spain. You definitely want to know the U.S. acquires several Spanish colonies after they defeat Spain. They get Puerto Rico in the Caribbean. They'll take Guam and the Philippines out in the Pacific. And basically, we establish ourselves as an imperial power. Cuba, we do not take. Be careful. We don't annex Cuba. We technically grant Cuba independence. The reason I put that in quotations because we actually force them, we give them independence. We force them to sign this agreement in their constitution called the Platt Amendment, where they essentially have to agree to allow the U.S. to intervene in Cuban affairs whenever we want to. So if we want to step in and change their foreign policy or domestic policy, we have the right to do that. So technically Cuba's independent after the war, but not really, because we essentially have control over their domestic and foreign policy. Also very important, if you remember, we annexed the Philippines, which also was a Spanish colony. The Philippines out in the Pacific off of China. The Filipino people don't want to be annexed. They want to be independent. They thought once Spain was defeated, they would be given independence. The U.S. is not interested in that because we really want the Philippines. It's obviously great for trade. It's right. It gives us like a major kind of holding over in the Pacific. And remember, essentially, we will fight a 3-year war with the Filipino independence movement called the Filipino-American War. And this war lasts way longer than the Spanish-American War and costs way more lives, you know, American and Filipino lives. And again, the U.S. will try to justify this by saying, well, you know, we're all for independence, but the Filipino people are not prepared to be independent. You know, this idea of social Darwinism, the white man's burden, we need to come in and like show them how to be civilized, you know. So again, of course, the U.S. is just wants the Philippines for their own personal interests. But any questions about that? Spanish-American War, very important. Definitely want to know that. Kind of launches us as an imperial power. Listen, I don't know if my Zoom shuts off, which it may in a second. I'll just send you guys out a new link in Remind. So bear with me if it shuts off on us, and we'll come back and we'll finish up real quick. All right. You do want to know some of the imperialist presidents, and really it's the same ones that were progressive presidents, because this is all happening during the same time. The most famous is Theodore Roosevelt. He was a big supporter of U.S. expansion. If you remember, he actually, he participated in the Spanish-American War. If you remember, he volunteered with this group called the Rough Riders, and they were involved in some of the combat in Cuba during the Spanish-American War. But I would definitely know Roosevelt was a big believer in building up the U.S. Navy. He thought the U.S. needed to start expanding its global influence, and he thought the way to do that was to build up our Navy. He was largely influenced by this guy named Alfred Mahan, who was an admiral at this time, who basically said the U.S., if we're going to be a world power, control trade, we need a strong Navy, just like England has, if we want to kind of hang with them. I would definitely know Theodore Roosevelt's foreign policy is referred to as big stick diplomacy. And basically what this means is that what Roosevelt says, we need to have a strong Navy. And basically we're not going to go out looking for fights, but if we have a strong Navy, basically we can use our military might to get things done around the world. You know, if a country doesn't want to negotiate with us, that we're not afraid to use kind of the threat of our military to might to kind of throw our weight around a little bit. So if you see any kind of political cartoons with Teddy Roosevelt with a big stick or a club, it's a reference to this idea that, you know, basically he's going to take this more aggressive foreign policy, which basically he's saying, you know, it comes from an African proverb, speak softly, but carry a big stick. That is, you know, we try to negotiate with countries, like we want to work things out diplomatically, but, you know, we always have this, our big Navy ready. If we need to use it to defend ourselves or to pull strings around the world, we're not afraid to do that. Okay. Actually, Teddy Roosevelt will send the Navy out on this like world tour called the Great White Fleet in the early 1900s. Basically, he has the Navy sail around to these international ports and just like dock there for a little while and then keep going. In reality, what he's doing is trying to like flex our muscle, show off to other countries, like, this is how powerful our Navy is. Do you really want to mess with us going forward? So Roosevelt's definitely advocating the use of kind of like military power, military might to get things done around the world. In this case, the big stick is a metaphor for our powerful Navy. Okay. Also important for Teddy Roosevelt, when he becomes president, he will add on to that foreign policy statement back in the 1800s called the Monroe Doctrine. If you remember the Monroe Doctrine, that was back under President James Monroe in the 1820s, where basically we told European powers, stay out of the Americas. You can't come over here and colonize Central South America anymore. And basically Roosevelt will make an addition to the Monroe Doctrine. A corollary just means an addition. And basically what Roosevelt says is European powers, we know, cannot come over to the Americas, but the U.S. can intervene in Latin America. We alone have the authority to intervene in Latin America. It's kind of like we're like the policemen of the Western Hemisphere. So if a country in Latin America is not, you know, paying debts to European countries, we don't want European countries coming over and trying to collect. That would be counter to the Monroe Doctrine. So to try to avoid that, you know, he passes the Roosevelt corollary saying basically we can go in and kind of help these countries get their economic situation, you know, situated if need be. Okay. One of his big goals, Teddy Roosevelt, is the Panama Canal. He wants the U.S. to build a canal through Central America that will connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. That would be beneficial for the U.S. for not only for trade, you know, instead of having to sail all the way around South America, now they can just cut through the canal. And, excuse me, also be important for military use too, so the Navy can go from one ocean to another quickly if they need to. Ultimately, you want to know, the U.S. will support a rebellion in Panama after Colombia basically refuses to let us build the canal. This is an example of big stick diplomacy, because we went to Colombia and said, hey, we want to build a canal here. We'll pay you this money if we can build a canal through this portion of your territory. And the Colombia says, no thanks. So the U.S., who doesn't want to take no for an answer, we will help start a rebellion in Panama, which was part of Colombia, the part we wanted to build the canal through. And basically, we will help them get independence, and then Panama will negotiate with us and let us build a canal. And, you know, we use our Navy to kind of hang off the coast of Panama to kind of as a threat to Colombia when this is happening. So an example of big stick diplomacy. The Panama Canal, very big, obviously, one of the biggest kind of achievements of Teddy Roosevelt's career. Okay. Taft, another important imperialist president who takes over after Teddy Roosevelt. His approach to foreign policy, whereas Teddy's was about military might, his foreign policy approach is called dollar diplomacy. It's the idea that, you know, instead of using our military might to get things done around the world, we're going to use our economic power to promote our interests. So what he advocated doing was like investing, U.S. investing in kind of Latin America and Asia, so that, you know, we would have a good working relationship with these nations. You know, that would be beneficial to us in the long run. And then Woodrow Wilson, who takes over after Taft, his policy is called moral diplomacy. That's his foreign policy approach, where he says, you know, the goal of the U.S. should basically be to spread democracy around the world. And basically what that meant was, in terms of foreign policy, the U.S. would only support countries that had democratic governments. In other words, you know, if a country didn't have a democratic government, they had like a dictatorship, then we would actually not like do business with them. We would put economic strains on them. So hopefully they would change. He has some doings with Mexico during this time where there's a dictator come to power and he basically refuses to acknowledge the dictator. We actually get into a little military fiasco with Mexico for a brief period of time. But definitely know about these different approaches to foreign policy. Here's how to know about Teddy Roosevelt's big stick diplomacy, know about the Roosevelt Corollary, know about Taft's dollar diplomacy, and know about Wilson's moral diplomacy, okay? So that kind of covers the progressive era and imperialism. Does anybody have any questions about any of that stuff real quick? Any questions about progressive era, reforms, imperialism? It's kind of key things to take away is that, first of all, the progressive era is important because the role of the federal government is changing during that time. Again, you know, and that really in the centuries before the early 1900s, before the progressive era, the government, federal government was viewed as kind of it needs to stay out of American society as much as possible. The federal government needs to be as limited as possible. Because really before this, the federal government was seen as like a threat to kind of American prosperity, American liberty. And that's going to start to change during the progressive era. These progressive reformers are basically saying, and these progressive presidents like Roosevelt and Taft and Wilson, they're going to start to kind of change the concept of the federal government. Instead of, you know, the federal government being a threat to kind of the well-being of the American people, progressives are going to say the government needs to be more involved to ensure that Americans have what they need, that, you know, the government has to be more involved, take a more active role to ensure the welfare of all of the American people, which again is a pretty new idea for a federal government that had been largely hands-off up to this point. Okay. And also you want to make kind of a comparison connection with the reform movements of the progressive era that are happening in the early 1900s. You want to connect those to the reform movements that happened in the early 1800s, you know, like the age of Jackson. Some of those continue, right? The women's reform movement, women's rights movement started in the early 1800s. It will continue up into the early 1900s, the progressive era, until we get the 19th Amendment. Same thing with temperance. That movement continues till we get prohibition with the 18th Amendment in 1919. So definitely connect those. In terms of imperialism, just make sure you know the U.S. is really starting to take a much more active foreign policy in the late 1800s, early 1900s. You know, we are really starting to try to, we're trying to establish ourselves as a kind of a global force. We want to control trade because our economy is booming. We need essentially more resources, more markets. We also obviously want to compete with European powers. We feel like we have this kind of mandate to expand because of ideas like social Darwinism, which is basically this idea that American culture is superior and that we have a right to spread our, you know, democracy, Christianity, capitalism to these uncivilized people. So definitely know about how the U.S. basically, the Spanish-American War is really a shifting point. Once we defeat Spain in 1898, we take the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico. We, you know, around the same time we annex Hawaii and we get bought Alaska earlier. The U.S. is really starting to become establishing itself as a global imperial power as we kind of roll into the 1900s. And definitely know, again, William McKinley was the president during the Spanish-American War. He gets assassinated in 1901. Teddy Roosevelt takes over. And remember, Teddy Roosevelt is he's an imperialist. He believes we should have a very active, the U.S. needs to take kind of like a premier role on the world stage, kind of be a real world player. And he is saying we need to build up our military, our Navy in particular, to be able to do this type of stuff. Okay. Any questions about any of that? So what we'll do tomorrow, if not, is we'll pick back up. We'll talk about World War I, talk about why the war started. We'll talk about kind of the aftermath of the war. We'll talk about the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, and kind of some of the big changes of that. We may do the Great Depression. I may save that for Thursday. We'll see. And then Thursday we'll finish up, go up through World War II. Okay. Any questions about any of this stuff? All right. I did want to, before y'all run off, I did want to, I guess this is going to hold up. I don't know. It's not kicking us out yet. I did want to real quick talk to y'all about a couple things. As far as test day, excuse me. Let's see if I can find this. I just want to reiterate this because I don't know how many of y'all have done it, but if you have not gone to this part of the blog, this AP kind of the day of the exam page, you need to make sure that you look at this testing guide. You need to read through this so you know what you're doing. Watch these videos. Make sure you've done the exam demo with whatever you're going to use for the exam. Make sure that you have tried it out, basically simulated the exam, so you're not, if something's wrong, you can be sure that it's going to work on whatever you're using. So do that. That way you have an idea of kind of what it will look like on exam day, kind of, so you're not kind of, if there's a problem, it's not something you have to worry about at that point. Let's look at this real quick. How many of y'all have made sure your email is correct on the College Board website? If you have not, you need to log into your AP account and basically go to your profile and make sure that you have that everything is up to date with your email, because remember, they're sending you your test ticket. You're supposed to get your test ticket tomorrow, Wednesday, a couple days for the test. And that will have your AP ID on it, which you will need to get into the test. If for some reason you don't get the email, check your junk mail, check your regular inbox. But make sure you've done that. If you have not, go on the AP website, go on to your My AP, go to your profile, make sure that your email is correct, so you're getting the right stuff. Make sure you got it checked that you're receiving like AP emails. If worse comes to worse and you don't get the email, because some of y'all are probably going to be asking me on exam day, you can still find your AP ID or like your tickets by logging into your AP account and basically going to like the registration tab, and you should be able to see your AP ID, which you need to be able to get into the test, all right? How early should you be logging on to get ready for the test? Because you know, what's first of all, what time is the test? Someone tell me what time the test is. Someone please tell me, hopefully you know.
Two.
When? Like what
Friday? Day?
Yes, Friday at 2. You need to get on how early? How far ahead of time should you be on there, ready up, set up and ready to go?
30 minutes before.
I would say so. I would go and get all my stuff set up now if I were you. Make sure you know where you're going to take it out, what you're using. Like, you know, are you going to write your essay? Are you going to type it? Because, you know, you need to have that figured out on your, whatever you're using, your computer, your tablet. You probably need to have some kind of situation set up for like a split screen where you can read the DBQ, but also write at the same time. If I were you, I would try to print out a copy of one of those like outlines that I gave you to help you organize your thoughts as you write. Make sure that you got all that ready now. By the way, talk to wherever you're in your house, talk to your family and let them know, like, hey, I have this test at this time. You need to be quiet. I'm using this room. People can't be in here, because it is cheating if you're interacting with people during the test. You can't have any guy interaction with people. You can Google stuff. You can do that. But social media and like people are like off limits. You can't do that. So, you know, like I said, like Googling is probably not going to help you much anyway, but if you want to try to Google something really quick, you can, but don't go onto Reddit. Don't go onto Twitter, Facebook and be talking to people through that. Like, you can't be messaging people. That's a no-no. Apparently they have stuff in place to catch that. Don't try it. If you want to get potentially pass the test, stay away from that. You can have your notes. You can have stuff like that to help you. You can Google stuff if you want to, but you can't talk to people. You can't, you know, can't be using social media to talk to people. So basically just don't talk to humans. Okay. I would also at the bottom of this, on the exam page, make sure you go through this exam checklist. you don't have to turn this in, but it's like, you better have all this ready before exam time. So let's real quick go through this. You need your A character API ID, which again, you should get an email, a test ticket, you know, on Wednesday, or when you register for the exam, you should have got like a confirmation email. If not, you can log on to My AP and find it. The name of your exam, you know, you're taking the U.S. history exam, just to make sure you're doing the right thing. Remember, our test is 2 o'clock this Friday. That's Eastern time. So if you're not in Eastern time, then you better check that out. Figure out what time, wherever you, if you're over in California, you better make sure that you're ready to go at what, 12, 11? I guess 11. So just make sure that you're, if you're not in the Eastern time zone, you double check. Don't make sure you're ready to go at the right time. So am I ready to test? You want to make sure you have this stuff, okay? Make sure you have your AP exam ticket. You should get a different ticket for each exam if you're taking more than one. And again, make sure that you have that is correct. It should have your AP ID on there, and like the name of the exam, the date and everything. Make sure it's correct. Check that. You should get the email tomorrow. Again, make sure you've gone to College Board and your email is correct. Make sure your device is plugged in. Very important. You have to use what browser? Do you might know what browser like you need to be probably should be using for this?
Chrome.
I'd use Chrome, but like if you look here, it says when I click on the link, the browser that opens is Chrome, Firefox for Edge. The exam will not open in other browsers. So make sure it's one of those. Okay. I think they recommended Chrome, but you know, make sure it's one of these major browsers or it's probably not gonna work. Make sure you've done the exam day demo. So you know, like it'll basically give you a simulation of what it will look like when you log in on Friday. And like it also simulates how you upload the exam. That way you can kind of practice how you'll do that. Because remember, you have 45 minutes to write, 5 minutes to upload. Or that's the recommended kind of breakdown. You have 50 minutes total to get it in. Okay. Like it says right here, if you're gonna be typing your exam, make sure you either have a Google Doc, a Word doc, or some type of document that you can type into. I think you can like directly type it into like, there's like a box in there, or you can like attach a document. By the way, this is very important. I have typed my 8-character API ID and my initials at the top of each document. Make sure you do that. You should already do that now. If you're gonna type or write today, tomorrow, I would go open up whatever document you're gonna use and go ahead and put this at the top of your pages. Do it now, like when you get off here, because you don't wanna be worrying about that on exam day. So make sure you do that. It's at the top of each page that you write. If you write it physically, you gotta do it. If you type it, do it as well. At the top of the page, you need to have your API ID, your 8-character API ID, and then your initials, all right? And if you're handwriting the exam, same thing. Just have everything ready. You know, you'll have to take a picture of it and upload that. So if you're going to do that, go ahead and figure all that out. Make sure you're ready to do that. The demo, again, will help you get ready for that. So make sure you've done the demo. Materials, you won't need any materials, like no required materials for your test. You might want to think about though having like a, like I said, downloading one of those kind of those DBQ-like guides where it will help you kind of organize your thoughts, streamline your writing. Security guidelines, again, just make sure you're not cheating. Don't talk to anyone. You can Google stuff if you need to, but you can't be talking to anyone physically or via social media, wherever the case may be, all right? Obviously, you can't copy stuff. Like that. If you plagiarize, you're gonna fail and they're gonna report you, so don't do that. It should obviously all be your original thoughts based on the documents. And obviously what you know from class, all right? If any of y'all have accommodations, which I don't know if you do, you should know that. You should have been contacted about that. If you don't have, hopefully all of you have a device. If you don't, you better let me know so that I can try to help you out and get something to you. During the exam, here's some important stuff. Don't refresh the browser, use the back arrow. I will use the exam questions open on my device so I can see the timer. and 5-minute warning. So make sure you got all that up so you can see all that. When I see the on-screen warning, the time is almost up, I'll stop working on my response and start the process of attaching, pasting, just to make sure you get it in. Because if you don't get it in by the 50 minutes, then it's too bad. So make sure, I would definitely stop and make sure you get everything uploaded, okay? If I accidentally close my browser tab, temporarily lose my internet connection or experience some other disruption, I will click on my e-ticket to rejoin my exam. So, hey, try to do that. If something happens, like crazy happens, there is a process where you can request a makeup. If something like your power goes out or internet cuts out, there is a process where you can apply and you'll be able to retake the exam. So, you know, but I would try to go back in and rejoin if someone kicks you out or something. And I think overall, that's the big stuff. You might have questions about kind of that exam day or anything. I just wanted to kind of touch on that. I'll run back over this. I'm probably, what I'm going to do is Thursday, I'm going to do one last, like I said, we'll do one last review, and I'll do before I start the review, I'll probably tell everybody, I'll strongly advise you get on and join the Zoom. Generally, it's been the same few of y'all that are on the Zooms, so I'm not really worried about you guys, but some of your classmates are going to get on there, and they haven't looked at anything, and they're going to be, in trouble because they're not prepared. Just make sure you've – my advice is this, and I think most of you probably have. If you haven't, go to this page of my blog, the kind of the exam day page. I think it's the very last tab. What do you need to know for exam day? Read through this testing guide. You can do it. It's not a lot. It's like a 50-page PDF, but it's not a lot to read. Read through this. Watch these quick little videos about making sure you're ready. This video is good. He kind of summarizes the key stuff in there. This is actually from the College Board. It tells you about taking the test. Do the exam day demo to get a feel for on whatever you're using, your phone or your computer or your tablet. Make sure you've done the demo so that you're kind of prepared for that. And then I would definitely go through this checklist and make sure you're ready to go. Remember, y'all test, like I said, test is Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern time. If you're not in Eastern time, figure that out when you need to get on. And I would definitely log on 30 minutes. You need to be on there. I would get on there earlier, but I don't think your ticket will actually work until 30 minutes before. So you need to be on your computer ready to go at 1:30, okay? And again, talk to wherever you're at. Let your family know, this is the time I'm doing this. I need y'all to be quiet. Keep distractions at a minimum. I would set aside a place for myself that you're going to do it, that you know you're not going to be bothered. Because remember, you're not supposed to be talking to anyone. So let them know that. Lock your door, whatever you need to do. Okay? Any questions about any of this stuff? Ask me now while we're still a few days out so I can answer anything. Have all of y'all gone in and made sure your email is correct on your AP account? If not, you definitely want to do that now. Go do that. Make sure that there's a box you check to make sure you're getting all the emails, because tomorrow you should get your test ticket for APUSH, okay? What are y'all testing? Is anyone testing on a phone? If you have any other way to test, I would probably not use a phone. This is going to be a pain in the ass, to be frank with you, to do that on the phone. If you got a computer, that's optimal. A tablet would be a little better than a phone. But all you have is a phone, you might want to think about writing it physically and then uploading pictures of it. Okay, that would be my advice. That way, you could just have on your phone. You could have the DBQ. Read through that and then write your actual DBQ, then just take photos of it and upload it. And again, I would do the demo if you're with whatever you're going to use, so you have how it's going to work on that device. Okay. Again, make sure that you write your AP ID and your initials at the top of every page. Go ahead and do that now tonight. If you're doing it on paper, get a few sheets of paper, write your ID. Which again, if you don't have your ID, you should be able to log in and find it on your AP account, or you'll get a test ticket with it tomorrow, which has it. So a number, APID, and your initials at the top of each page. Type it if you're typing it at the top of each page. Write it if you're writing it. Go ahead and do that now before Friday, okay? All right, questions. Y'all never have questions, which worries me sometimes. So you're all ready to make a 10 out of 10. Did y'all watch that video I sent the other day where it was like basically strategy? I think I sent like a day or two ago. Then y'all know what I'm talking about how many points you should shoot for. We've talked about this. What point should you probably not worry about on this exam? In terms of the rubric, what have I recommended not to worry about? Does anyone remember? Nabil, what do you got? Are you just asking me a question? Yeah, I would put in the margin, Nabil. Or like your header is what I would do. So listen, what I would do strategy-wise is this. Unless you're shooting for a perfect score, or you just read the prompt, you're like, oh, I know this inside out, this is easy, I would not worry about trying to get the complexity point. I wouldn't worry about all that. And I probably wouldn't worry about the contextualization point. It's because it takes a bit of time to write like several sentences of background. If you finish and you've got time and you want to go back and put contextualization before your thesis, maybe do that. But what I would tell you guys personally, and again, this is just advice because, again, you have limited time. Get the point for the thesis. Make sure you have a good thesis that has a line of reasoning where you're making like an obvious claim that you can argue, and you mention a couple points you're going to argue in the body paragraphs. And I would probably do two body paragraphs. You can try to do three, but honestly, I'd probably try to keep it at two. So get the thesis point. You need to use at least two documents successfully. You got five documents to read. I would try to use three in case you screw one up. For those three documents, what I would do, you have to have explain the content of the document correctly, show how the content supports your thesis, and then you need to try to somehow in your writing work in sourcing, like explain how the point of view of the author of that document is relevant to your argument. Explain what the purpose of writing that document was and how that's relevant to your argument. Explain who the intended audience was for that document and why that's relevant. Probably the easiest one to get is explain some historical situation, like what's happening when that document was written or whatever it was published or whatever the case may be. That gives us a little bit of like it, that is, you know, relevant to understanding it. Okay. You only have to do one of those. You don't have to do all those for each time. So, you know, if you can explain the POV and why it's important for one of the documents, that's good. That'll get you a point. If you can explain the historical context for one of the other document, that's good. That'll get you a point. Okay. So do that for two documents. Try to do it for three just in case you mess up. Okay. And then how many pieces of outside evidence should you have? Come on, you should be confident. Listen, if y'all don't know the DBQ rule right now, we're in trouble. How many points can you get for outside information? Someone step up to the plate. Are y'all there? Should I shut this down?
Don't you get 2 points for every piece of evidence?
So the max amount of points you get for outside evidence, that's information not included in the documents, is 2. So if you use 2 pieces of outside information to strengthen your argument, then you'll get 2 points. If you use 1 piece, you'll get 1 point. So you should be able to do that. If you've been doing the content review, you should be able to pull some little nugget of information and incorporate it into your argument. It obviously has to be relevant. It has to support your argument somehow. But, you know, I think you can do that. So that's what you need to be shooting for. Get the thesis point. That's key. Get the points for, obviously, you know, you can get 3 points if you use 4 documents. I wouldn't do that. I would use 3 documents. That way you definitely get the points for using 2 documents in case you screw up. And what that means, you have to explain what the content of the document, what it means, show how the content supports your argument, and then for two of the documents, show how the point of view, the purpose, the intended audience, the historical situation, one of those things is relevant to your argument, and then use two pieces of outside information to further strengthen your argument, and then you should pass. And honestly, you'll probably get like a four. What would be a 4 out of 5 most years? Okay. I would not worry about though, just me personally, you can if you want to, but I would not worry about the complexity point at all. I wouldn't worry about that. If you have time, after you're done, and you think it's good, and you want to go back and do some historical background, some context before your thesis, do that. And I would also recommend write your thesis again at the end after your second body paragraph or third, whatever you do. Go back and restate your thesis just in case. You know, sometimes you'll kind of get a better grasp of your thesis as you write it, especially because you don't have much time. And, you know, restating it, you know, if they read it the first time, they don't give you the point. Maybe after reading your paper and you've kind of developed your idea a little more, reading it again, they may end up giving you the point. So I would recommend restating your thesis at the end just one more time. You don't need a conclusion. You don't need to do that. Just maybe restate the thesis one more time. Yeah. Okay. Questions. Questions about tickets, APIVs, test day, studying. You are also quiet. Listen, I mean, I think if you've been doing your review, I think you'll be okay. Again, just you need to have it. Know the rubric. If you don't know the rubric and how to get the points, that's kind of the basis of all this. If you don't understand the rubric, ask me. I'm happy to Zoom with you individually. Message me on Remind. I'll talk to you about the rubric and how you get the points. Okay. If you want me to look at something, like you wrote something, like practice DBQ, you want me to look at it, email it to me. Let me know you email it. Sometimes it goes into my junk mail. Be studying your content using the stuff on my website, using your notes. And, you know, I think you'll be okay. Again, like I said, but you need to go on with a clear strategy. Make sure you know the rubric, know which points you want to get, how many documents you want to use, and then just like maximize your time doing that. Okay. Any questions? If not, tomorrow we'll do the same time. 1 to 2-ish, we'll do part 2 of period 7. And then I'll probably finish up 7 on Thursday. I'll put this, I'll send these out one more time. I'll put this on the blog. That was to Nabil. Sorry, Nabil, I'm going to send it to you privately. Here's the link to part 1 of the period 7 notes that we were just looking at. If you want, I'll put this on the blog too. Questions? All right, well, if not, y'all can go. If you want to hang around and ask me something, just let me know. But whenever you want to, just message me, guys. I'm fine. You're not bothering me. Just let me know if you got a question or concern. That way we can go and get it taken care of before exam day. All right?
I did want to ask, can you send out the review, this review to like,
I think you know, like the recording, I think I saw your message. Like it's recording. I'll try to get it. Like, I think it'll take a second to like upload and I'll try to upload or I can send it to you. I'll see what I can do about that.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Come in. What part did you come in on? She's gone. Okay. Nabil, you good? Yeah, you can message me. Or you can talk to me now, whatever you want to do. It's just me and you now. You just going to text me tonight or do you want to talk now? Okay. Yeah, just let me know. Just like I said, big things is make sure you know the rubric inside out. Make sure you go into clear strategy. What are you taking the exam on? Like what? Are you on a computer, phone, tablet? Okay, so you'll be fine. I would probably have like, are you gonna type it or write it? So make sure you have like a, go ahead and play around with that. You know, so you can have like a split screen. And have you done the demo that College Board, the kind of simulation? If not, you need to do that with your computer so you can go and get an idea of like how you're going to have the I would do that like ASAP tonight, tomorrow. That way you can get a feel like what you probably want, like a split screen, or one screen you have like the College Board at the website where the DBQ will be on, then you have like your document you're going to use, whether it's a Word document or a Google document. Or you can write it, have everything on the screen and write it and then take pictures. That might be more of a pain in the butt to do, but yeah. What, go through and make sure you've looked at all that exam day stuff though. And like I said, if you have questions, just shoot me a message, all right? Yeah, do the demo anyway. Even if you'll be fine, but it'll make that way you make sure whatever you know what you're going to be using for the exam day is like ready to go. You have an idea what it'll look like and how you can have your writing, you know, where you should put all that. So yeah, I would definitely do the demo just to get a feel for it. All right. Let me know if you have any questions. Message me and I'll help you out. All right. Have a good afternoon.